Geekscape.com.
White supremacy and Negro subordination, part 9. Chapter 11. The brain. The brain is the seat or the center of the intellect, in short, the mental organism. The schoolmen believed that mind, intellect, the reasoning faculty, whatever we may term it, had no locality or organism, but on the contrary, was some impalpable, shadowy, unfixed principle that existed as much in the feet or hands as in any other portion of the body. And even Locke and Bacon, while they promulgated the great truths of inductive philosophy, were not sufficiently grounded in its elementary principles to understand clearly the foundation of their own doctrines. Nor did Dugald Stewart, Dr. Brown, or even the great Kant of more modern times understand any better the fixed truths on which rest the vast and imperfect systems of philosophy which they laboured so assiduously to build up in their day. It remained for Gall, Spurzheim, and their followers to do this, to demonstrate certain great elementary truths, which form a foundation, eternal as time itself, for the mental phenomena to rest upon, and whatever advances may be made hereafter in the study of these phenomena, its basis is immovable. Metaphysicians were wont to shut themselves up in their libraries and to analyze their own emotions, which, when noted down, became afterwards the material for ponderous lectures or the still more ponderous volumes inflicted on society. Rarely, perhaps, were these speculations connected with the brain. Indeed, it is a rare thing to find a physiologist indulging in metaphysical speculation, while the most famous among the philosophers were profoundly ignorant of that organ, though they fancied they knew all about its functions. The man that should undertake to write a treatise on respiration, and at the same time was utterly ignorant of the structure of the lungs, or to give a lecture on the circulation, while he knew nothing of the blood vessels, would certainly be laughed at, and yet innumerable volumes have been written, and continue to be written, on the functions of the brain, or on moral and mental philosophy, by men who never saw a human brain in all their lives. Gall and Spurzheim did, therefore, a great good to the world when they began their investigations of the laws of the mind by the study of the brain itself, as the first and absolutely essential step to be taken in these investigations. It is true, they, and especially their followers, sought to set up a fancy science under the name of phrenology, and the former thus, to a great extent, neutralized a reputation which otherwise would have secured the respect of the scientific world. And it is also true that others before them had recognized the same truths, with more or less distinctness, but it is certain that Gall and Spurzheim demonstrated and placed, beyond doubt, the great, vital, and essential truth that the brain is the organ of the mind, and that the mental capacity, other things being equal, is in exact proportion to the size of the brain, relatively with the body. This truth holds good throughout the animal world, and the intelligence of any given animal or species of animal is always in keeping with the size of the brain when compared with the size of the body. The brain is composed of anterior and posterior portions of the cerebrum and the cerebellum, the first the center of intelligence, the latter of sensation, or the first the seat of the intellect, and the latter of the animal instincts, and the proportions they bear to each other determine the character. As the anterior portion is enlarged and the posterior diminished, the creature ascends, or as the anterior portion is diminished and the posterior portion enlarged, it descends in the scale of being. These are the general laws governing men and animals. There is intelligence in proportion to the size of the brain compared with that of the body, and in the former there is intellectual capacity, latent or real, in proportion to the enlarged cerebrum and diminished cerebellum. It is true we see every day seeming contradictions to the laws in question, but they are not so, not even exceptions, for they are not general, but universal. Every day we meet people with small heads and great intelligence, with large heads and large stupidities, but a closer examination may disclose the truth, that the seemingly small head is all brain, all cerebrum, all in front of the ears, while the large one is all behind, and only reveals a largely developed animalism. And even when this is not sufficient to explain the seeming anomaly, there is a vast and inexhaustible field for conjecture of accident, where misapplied or undeveloped powers have been the sport of circumstance. A man may have a large brain, great natural powers, in truth, genius of the most glorious kind, and the world remain in total ignorance of the fact, and among the countless millions of Europe, doomed generation after generation to a profound animalism. There, doubtless, have been many mute, inglorious Miltons who have lived and died and made no sign of the divinity within. On the contrary, there have been men of much distinction, of great usefulness to their fellows and to the generations after them, who, naturally considered, were on the dead level of the race, but by their industry, perseverance, and energy have left undying names to posterity. Then again, circumstances have made men great. An epoch in the annals of a nation, great and stirring events in the life of a people, stimulate and call into exercise qualities and capacities that make men famous, who otherwise would not be heard of. Our own great revolutionary period furnished examples of this, and still later we have Jackson, Webster, Clay, Calhoun, and their senatorial contemporaries, who many doubtless think will never be equaled, though their equals in fact are in the Senate now, and only need similar circumstances to manifest that equality. The organism of the race, the species, whether human or animal, never changes or varies from that eternal type fixed from the beginning by the hand of God, and men, therefore, are now in their natural capacities what they always have been and always will be, whatever the external circumstances that may control or modify the development of these capacities. And the brain, being the organ or organism of the mind, as the eye is of the sight, or the ear of the sense of learning, it may be measured and tested, and its capabilities determined, with as entire accuracy as any other function or faculty. Not, it is true, as the phrenologists or craniologists contend, that the brain reveals the character of individuals of the same species, but the character of the species itself, and its relative capabilities, when contrasted with other races or species of men. This is beyond doubt or question, or will be beyond doubt or question, with all those who understand it, and taking the Caucasian as the standard or test, the capabilities of the Mongol, the Malay, the Aboriginal American, or Negro may be determined with as absolute certainty as the colour of their skins or any other mere physical quality. The brain of the Caucasian averages 92 cubic inches, that of the Negro 75 to 85 inches. While the bodily proportions can scarcely be said to vary, there are great variations among whites as to size. There are giants as well as dwarfs, and quite as great variety in the form, from the lean and hungry Cassius to the rounded proportions of a Falstaff or Daniel Lambert. But on a southern plantation of 1,000 Negroes, sex and age are the only difference, or the principal difference, that one sees, and a stranger would find some trouble to recognize any other, or at all events, to distinguish faces. The brain of the Negro corresponds in this respect with the body, and though there are doubtless cases where there is some slight difference, there seems to be none of those wide departures witnessed in these respects among whites. The material, the fibre or texture of the brain itself, is little understood, and though it is quite likely that what we call genius is attended by a corresponding delicacy or fineness of texture in the nervous mass, and future exploration in this abstruse matter may reveal to us important truths, at this time little is known in regard to the brain, except the great fundamental and universal law that in proportion to its size, relatively with that of the body, is their intellectual power, actual or latent. Many doubtless fancy that there are immense differences in men in this respect, that a Webster or Clay or Bonaparte are vastly superior to common men, but they have only to remember that the brain is the organ of the intellect to see its fallacy. The notion has sprung from the habitudes of European society, where a man clothed in the pomp and parade of high rank is supposed to be vastly and immeasurably superior to his fellows, while in truth, most of these, or at all events, many of these, are absolutely, naturally inferior to the base multitudes that prostrate themselves in the dust at their feet. Nevertheless, there are striking differences in these respects, not more so, however, than in strength of body, beauty or features, difference of hair, complexion, etc. But in the case of the Negro, there is an eternal sameness, a perpetual oneness, the same colour, the same hair, the same features, same size of the body, and the same volume of the brain. All the physical and moral facts that make up the Negro being irresistibly lead to the conclusion that the Almighty Creator designed him for juxtaposition with the superior white man, and therefore such a thing as a Negro genius, a poet, inventor, or one having any originality of any kind whatsoever, is totally unnecessary, as they are totally unknown in the experience of mankind. Some, with more or less white blood, have exhibited more or less talent, possibly even have shown eccentric indications of genius, but among a million adult, typical Negroes, there probably would not be a single brain that would vary from the others sufficiently to be detected by the eye, and therefore not an individual Negro whose natural capacities were so much greater than those of his fellows as to be recognized by the reason. Such are, briefly, the leading and fundamental facts that constitute the mental organism and distinguish the intellectual character of races, that separate white men and Negroes by an interval broader and deeper than in any other form of humanity, and render an attempted social equality not merely a great folly, but a gross impiety. As has been stated, in exact proportion to the volume of brain, relatively with the size of body, in men and animals, there is intelligence, and as the cerebrum or anterior portion predominates over the cerebellum, or posterior portion, there is a corresponding predominance of intellectualism over animalism in the human races. The Negro brain, in its totality, is 10-15% less than that of the Caucasian, while in its relations, the relatively large cerebellum and small cerebrum, the inferiority of the mental organism is still more decided. Thus, while in mere volume, And therefore, in the sum total of mental power, the Negro is vastly inferior to the white man. The relative proportion of the brain and of the animal and intellectual natures adds still more to the Caucasian superiority, while it opens up before us abundant explanations of the diversified forms in which that superiority is continually manifested. There are no terms or mere words that enable us to express the absolute scientific superiority of the white man. We can only measure it, or indeed comprehend it, by comparison. But this will be sufficiently intelligible when it is said that the past history and present condition of both races corresponds exactly with the size and form of the brain in each. The science, the literature, the progress, enlightenment, and intellectual grandeur of the Caucasian, from the beginning of authentic history to this moment, and which have accompanied him from the banks of the Nile to those of the Mississippi, are all fitting revelations of the Caucasian brain, while the utter absence of all these things, the long night of darkness that enshrouds the Negro being, and which is only broken in upon when in juxtaposition and permitted to imitate his master, is the result or necessity of his mental organism. There being nothing superior to the Caucasian, it may be said that he is endowed with unlimited powers. That is, while the mental organism remains the same, his powers of acquisition and the increase of his knowledge have no limit. A generation, in the exercise of its faculties, acquires a certain amount of knowledge. This is transmitted to the next. It, in turn, adds its proportion, and so on, each generation, in its turn, accepting the knowledge of its progenitors, and transmitting with its own acquisitions the sum total to its successors. This is called civilization, and we can suppose no limit to it, except it be in the destruction of the existing order and a new creation. On the contrary, the Negro brain is incapable of grasping ideas, or what we call abstract truths, as absolutely so as the white child, indeed as necessarily incapable of such a thing as for a person to see without eyes, or hear without ears. In contact with, and permitted to imitate, the white man, the Negro learns to read, to write, to make speeches, to preach, to edit newspapers. But all this is like that of the boy of 10 or 12 who debates a la Webster or declaims from Demosthenes. People ignorant of the Negro mistake this borrowed for real knowledge, as one ignorant of metals may have a brass watch imposed upon him for a golden one. The Negro is, therefore, incapable of progress, a single generation being capable of all that millions of generations are, and those populations in Africa, isolated from white men, are exactly now as they were when the Hebrews escaped from Egypt, and when they must be millions of years hence if left to themselves. Of course, this is no mere opinion or conjecture of the author. It is a necessity of the Negro being, a consequence of the Negro structure, a fixed and eternally inseparable result of the mental organism, which, without a recreation, another brain, could no more be otherwise than water could run uphill, or a reversal of the law of gravitation in any respect could be possible. But people, ignorant of the elementary principles of science, as well as of the nature of the Negro, fancy that this is quite possible, that however inferior the organism of the Negro in these respects, it is the result of many centuries of savagery and slavery, and therefore if